I think last time I went up to the second noble truth of craving being the cause of suffering, and especially, yes, last week, about the three types of craving. But it's that craving, as it's mentioned there, which gives rise to fresh rebirth. So, which is bound up with pleasure, lust, which now here, now there, finds ever fresh delight, but which gives fresh rebirth. Now, I mention that because when we go into the first paragraph of the third noble truth, what now is the noble truth of the extinction of suffering? It is the complete fading away and extinction of that very craving. We've just got this craving up here. That this craving refers to the craving which was just mentioned in the second noble truth, the craving which gives rise to rebirth. It's good actually to make that connection. So the extinction of suffering is a complete fading away and extinction of the craving which leads to rebirth. Which again makes the point that the whole point of Buddhism is not to get reborn again.
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
If it's not me who's reborn, what, you know, why should I care?
Why should I care? Because there's still a process of suffering. You want to extinguish suffering. Even though it's not you who's suffering now, still it hurts. Even though if you really realize that you're not suffering now, still you're still... not put your hand in the fire, you still have a good rest tonight, you still look after your body, look after your mind.
But that, you know, the thing is, what is going to be reborn? That's not me either.
Is it?
Why do I care about that?
Aha! Uh-huh. If you really thought that way, you mean, you think right now, to be consistent, if you really thought that way, you wouldn't care about the suffering now, or the suffering tomorrow. Why worry about what you're going to feel like tomorrow? It's not going to be the same you. So the point is that there is the sense of self there. There is the identification of the suffering you experience from day to day.
Okay.
Rebirth is just like waking up in a new morning, only it's a new body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no different than the process in this life, which you can see, of going to bed at night and waking up in the morning. And obviously you're very concerned about making sure when you wake up tomorrow morning that you'll be healthy and be free of suffering. There's going to be food there for you, it's going to be warm enough, you're going to have enough blankets on there. Then the same reason why you look after your body and look after your suffering right now, for that very same reason you look after your suffering for the next life. In theory it sounds good, but if you look more deeply you find it's just a little bit of an escape. Yeah. Craving, they said, the craving to stop craving. Which is a weird one, but it's still, it's a type of craving. Even a craving to get a nimitta.
Is there a craving that doesn't lead to rebirth?
Not really.
So why does Buddha say all craving?
Well, because he wanted to point out that the whole problem is rebirth. It is craving that gives rise to fresh rebirth. It's bound up with pleasure and lust, now here, now there, finds ever fresh delight. In one sense, you might say the craving for the jhanas, the attachment to the jhanas, doesn't really lead to rebirth, in the sense that you just go into the sort of jhana realm, and most people that stream on it will just get extinguished there. So it doesn't really, in a sense, but to make it quite clear, the point of this is to end rebirth. So make this your last life, and making that very, very clear. So if it's just, say, just to end craving, they may look upon as being that you can have sort of a happiness in this life. Just stop all your craving in this life, and then you'll be happy. But it doesn't work that way. Yeah. It does, yeah, and it doesn't really work, because you don't get jhanas then. So this is the problem. It's a craving, and if you try it, then again it doesn't work. So it's like the only craving which I recommend is the craving to stop, to let go, to renounce. In other words, the thing which stops craving. It does, yeah, but it's also just seeing that all craving is a separation from where you are and where you want to be. As it said in the first noble truth, separation from the light, from the craved, is suffering. So as soon as you have craving, any time craving comes up for anything, Eat good stuff, bad stuff, anything. It's suffering. Craving is suffering. Because it's our hunger. It's, the word actually is the same in Pali as thirst. You know, it means it's sort of a thing which you have to do, you have to work, you have to go, you can't be peaceful. It's driving you along, it's stopping you being still, there's something to be done. And it's a separation. You're here and you want to be somewhere else. And that's the definition of suffering. So all craving is suffering. And of course it gives you that momentum of going to the next thing. Sort of getting to where you want to be. And of course that momentum is the force which gives rise to rebirth. Something else you want. Some other place you want to be. And that's the thing which moves, which creates the future. If you don't know how to be still right now, when you die, you will be creating some sort of future somewhere where you want to be. You can't... Sorry?
Is that why when you have the hindrance of restlessness, it's so important just to be content?
That's right, yeah. Contentment is one of the most important keys. Contentment is a great English word which means no desire. Don't want to be anywhere else. So contentment gives rise to peace, gives rise to stillness. And when it's stillness, it's an end of desire, an end of craving. So, it is... God.
I don't know, sometimes one can see it, well, even small things, like a desire to be in a certain place or something. You can feel that force in the mind, and you can think, yeah, that would create rebirth.
Yeah.
When that arises, you just make peace with it.
Yeah, okay, yeah, make peace with it. I've got to be sensible though, because if it's a craving, the desire, you know, to actually to go to the toilet before you dump, it's a very good thing to do, to follow that craving. So don't just dump in the meditation hall. But that, you have to follow some cravings. It is. Repression of mind. And how many times you've gone there and you think, is this it? You know, you've gone to see the Great Wall of China, you've gone to see the Amazon, you've gone to see sort of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, you've gone to see all this other stuff and say, is this it? And what are we doing this for? We're just running around. Probably at first. Yeah. Yeah.
So if I die, it's like going to because I don't know where I'm going to be.
That's right. Dangerous.
I understand the concept of rebirth and what is being carried forward.
Okay, it's like, again, it's one's momentum, that sort of one's craving, one's attachments, those idiosyncrasies. That's actually what gets carried forward. One's likes and dislikes. So all that conditioning which you've had, which doesn't, is not really seen in the particulars of your everyday life, but which is the general momentum or direction of your life. Whether you like going to the pub, or whether you like this type of music, whether you like this type of sex, or whether you like just reading books, those inclinations which you build up here, that certainly will be there for you afterwards. Where you find pleasure and delight. Ever finding delight, now here, now there.
That's why we tend to have a certain inclination.
Yeah.
That's what we do. So this is that inclination for previous many lives.
That's right, yes.
The momentum, the forces, the life forces, what it's called.
Yeah. I mean, a good example of that is that person which I mentioned. He was obviously not a Buddhist. He was an English comedian called Roy Hudd. Do you remember Roy Hudd? Did you hear me tell the story when he wrote about when he got lost in a new one-way system in London? And he was driving and just didn't know where he was and went down a street and it's a one-way street. Sorry, it's a dead-end street, but you know that's the only place he could go. And hairs on the back of his head sort of started rising as he realized that he'd been in the street before in a previous life. And all his memories came back because in a place like London, the architecture hardly changes at all. Maybe inside they redo the houses, but outside it looks exactly the same. And when he went to the house, he knew exactly who he was before. And there was actually the blue signs on the outside, because he was actually a very well-known music hall comedian before. And in this time, he was like an entertainer on the TV. And it was actually a very... I remember this, because I knew something about sort of that. It was Dan Leno. He was actually quite a famous music hall performer, Dan Leno. And they had this blue plaque outside, Dan Leno lived here and there's so many years. And this guy Roy had said, that was me. He knocked on the door, and because he was well enough known as a TV personality, they opened the door and said, what do you want? He said, oh, I used to live here before. No, you couldn't have done it. He said, but I was Dan Leno. He took him all around the house and showed him exactly what it was before when he lived there. And he went on sort of to write this article in the magazine. And of course, you know, that would have crippled his career if he wasn't actually serious about this. And the interesting thing was, I totally believe that that was actually true, that the interesting thing was his inclination, his actually career before was like as an entertainer in sort of Edwardian England. Now, in his next life, he was also an entertainer. Not quite up to the same standard, but still good enough to get on TV. Slipping down, yeah, losing it. Well, again, they would do, yeah, but Ian Stevenson was very, very careful to make sure it was like young people who couldn't get information from any other way. Because the information on places like on Dan Leno, you can get that anywhere because he was a very famous man. So it's the inclinations which you carry into your future life. And to actually understand that, again, it's very much the case you get into meditation, you know the power of the mind and the primacy of the mind. And just in the same way, when you get into a jhana, your body actually disappears. It's not relevant anymore. And just that experience of knowing how this mind can be totally independent of the body, you know that the body can die, and that sort of mind is separate from the body. So it doesn't die when the mind dies, when the body dies. And that's something from the experience of the deep meditations. It's very obvious. The sort of the separation of the mind and the body. And the fact that the mind is not dependent on the body, it's not some byproduct of a body, it's totally independent. If anything, the body is sort of dependent upon the mind, and what you do with your mind creates this body this way or that way, especially sicknesses and health and character. But sort of when you realize the independence of the mind, then it's quite obvious, even if you don't remember your past lives, that when your body dies, cuts it, finishes, gone. That mind continues on. And the next question is, you know, is that mind a soul? As I mentioned last week, you see it very clearly. It is like just a river, it just continually changes from moment to moment. So that's actually how rebirth happens. If you remember your past life, then it's exactly the same as remembering what you did yesterday. You know, you just, it's a continuation of experience, but you know, just in a new body. Like many of you have been in new countries, you know, new clothes. Is that right? Okay? Okay, there's a couple of other questions. Danny, are you?
How much that your aspirations are not good, just to make the bar.
It's much better not to have any aspirations except just to sit a lot and walk a lot. Much better, because remember, aspirations agitate the mind. Even an aspiration is another word for a desire, wanting to get somewhere. So if you really want to get deep in your meditation, find out the nature of your mind, find out sort of, you know, how this rebirth process happens, then one needs to sort of have stillness, a huge amount of stillness. Yep. We'll find out in a few moments. Okay, let's get on with things. So, what now is this noble truth of extinction of suffering? It is a complete fading away and extinction of this craving. It's forsakenment, abandonment, liberation, and detachment for it. Now, those four words don't make much sense there, but I've taught a lot about those four words in Pali. It's chaga, pati, nisaga, muti, analaya. So I've made some whole Dhamma discourses just on those four words. The forsaking, when people make translations from the Pali, again, you miss so much. Because chaga is also used in other senses for giving. So this is actually generosity, giving. And that's a very important way of letting go of craving. This doesn't mean just making donations. I should actually say that these books, actually, we've got the monastery has to pay $5 to the Buddhist Society for these. So if anyone wants to make a contribution, because we have to sort of pay the library, these came from the library of Nolamara. So giving is not just giving donations. Giving is actually, as I mentioned in many talks, giving yourself to the meditation, expecting nothing back in return. That's what giving really means. So you don't expect something back. It's just giving. I think. Okay, do you want to sort of turn it off? Because they're running out of gas. Just press. No, do you know to the record? Yes. Very good. So it's first one is giving, expecting nothing back in return. So look at that one as no expectations, no wanting. Whatever you do, it's not getting something back. That means it is letting go. Stopping craving. Abandonment, patinisagam, is literally throwing things away. And again, it's the opposite. Craving accumulates things. It's patinisaga, abandons things. Mutti, liberation. That is almost what happens when you end craving. But I think I made a very good point in many talks. The simile of the prison, why people like to be in a monastery and then trying to get out of a prison. Because a prison is any place you don't want to be. Any place you want to be is called freedom. So that's why sometimes somebody told me that there was up in the north of Western Australia this indigenous person, he's only just released from jail, and he reoffended. And they asked him, why do you reoffend so soon? He said, so I can see the next episode of this soap opera, which I was wanting to see. He didn't have a television himself, had one in the prison. And that's the excuse he gave. So for him, like being in prison was actually freedom, because he didn't have so much problems. Food and TV to watch. So anyway, wherever you feel free, in other words, where you want to be, this is what it means here. So this is a very nice point. If you want to be here, that's called freedom. If you want to be somewhere else, you're in Nimitta, you want to get in jhana. You're in Bodhinyana Monastery and you want to be in Dharmasavadana's Monastery or whatever. If you want to be somewhere else, that's called craving. Wanting to be here is called freedom. And of course, Analia, as Analia knows, means a place where there is no roosting, nothing settles. The Teflon mind, as I called it. So in other words, craving, it doesn't accumulate. Now you get some idea what this craving means. It's very close to attachment, sticking. And so that's why we have to give, expecting nothing back in return. We have to just throw things away, be happy to be here, and have nothing stick to us, especially not the past. Whatever happened in the past is gone. Questions? Yeah. No, it's freedom's not where you want to be. If you want to be here, then you have freedom. If you want to be somewhere else, you've made a prison.
So, freedom from craving would be you want to be in the state you're in, you're not craving some other state?
Freedom from craving means that you're just happy to be here, so you don't crave to be anywhere else. You don't crave to have anything else. It's another word for contentment again. But where may this craving vanish? Where may it be extinguished? Wherever in this world there are delightful and pleasurable things, there this craving may vanish, there it may be extinguished. In other words, right here, not sort of after you die, not in some heaven realm, you extinguish craving right here, in the midst of pleasant things. But, okay, I have to go, because too many questions, we don't get anywhere. Actually, I do want to get somewhere, so I'm craving now. Be it in the past, present, or future. Whosoever of the monks or priests regards the delightful and pleasurable things in this world as impermanent, the delightful and pleasurable things in this world as impermanent, miserable, or suffering, I've got it suffering instead of miserable, dukkha, and without a self, as diseases and cankers, they're the ones who overcomes craving. Well, that's a very good point there. One who understands anicca dukkha anatta, so anything delightful and pleasurable, it's not going to last. It's just disappears. So just why have so much craving or work so hard and strive so much for something which is going to disappear anyway? Why worry about pains or aches or disappointment or what people say about you, because that's going to pass away. So when you sort of understand the power of impermanence, you just leave things alone. You just don't have much craving anymore. Especially when you understand them as suffering. So who wants to crave for a piece of shit? It's suffering. No one would like to crave for something like that. So if you actually see it as something like that, what do I want to sort of have all this stuff for? It's just a problem. It's a burden. And it's without a self. In other words, it doesn't really belong to me anyway. It belongs to nature. It's nothing to do with me. It's not mine. It's not me. It's not my essential being. So, you know, if people call me an idiot, it's, no, my reputation has nothing to do with me. There's no self in here. So you just let it go. So you understand any of these delightful and pleasurable things, especially unpleasant words about you, or even pleasant words about you, it's nothing to do with me. So you don't crave praise, and you don't get upset with blame. There's diseases, and diseases in the sense they're going to cause you a lot of problems. And cankers, who knows what a canker meant? A canker is another old English word for ball and chain that they used to put on prisoners. And the reason they used to put these balls and chains on prisoners, or like these handcuffs put on people's legs, they were called cankers as well, was so you couldn't move freely through the world. So that these pleasurable things, they're just burdens. They're like ball and chain, which stops you being free.
I thought canker is black stuff coming out, oozing out of a tree.
No, that's not canker.
It's not canker, the black, you know, that...
Cankers is actually what they sort of use in prisons. Okay. Canker, no. Of course. That's just...
That outflowing from a tree.
No, that's not a canker. No. Sorry? Sap. It's resin or sap, yeah. No, cankers is what they used for prisoners in the old days.
Thanks.
Okay, now your question.
What does it say, extinguishment, where there are delightful and pleasurable things, but it doesn't mention the more kind of obvious stuff, and where there's a lot of ill will towards something?
Yeah, but where there's ill will, I suppose that obviously one wants to get rid of the ill will, but the hardest thing is actually to... That's almost like an obvious, everyone can do that. But how many people can sort of willingly give up their pleasures when they're available to you? That's why they also say, like in the Dhammapada, when a young man or a young woman enters a sangha, that's a beautiful thing. It's an amazing thing, just like the full moon on a cloudless night. Much more so than when an old person joins the sangha. You can see that because the young person is giving up so much. They've got all their pleasures in life. And they're giving up. So the old people, they've had their pleasures and stuff. So they're trying to get it both ways. That's what it says. Anyway, dependent extinction of all phenomena. Now, it's nice he calls it dependent extinction. I sometimes call it dependent cessation. Because in Buddhism, they have the doctrine of dependent origination. And people always talk about dependent origination and where this body-mind stuff comes from and how rebirth actually happens without a soul. That's actually the whole point of dependent origination. But it's also nice to call dependent cessation, which very few people actually mention. And that's the most important, dependent cessation. How cessation happens, or how extinction happens, as a causal process. And so here we go, and through the total fading away and extinction, remember, total fading away and extinction of craving, this upadana is extinguished. And they call it clinging, and again, I think you all know that its much better word is actually fuel. And it's actually used as fuel many, many times in Pali. And I mentioned before, upadana, taking up. So when there's no craving, you don't take up those objects. And through the extinction of this fuel, the states of existence, not the process of becoming, the states of existence are extinguished. And through the extinction of the states of existence, there's no place to get reborn into, because you don't create those places, you don't crave for them, you don't fuel them. So that rebirth is extinguished. And through the extinction of rebirth, the old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are also extinguished. This comes about, thus comes about the extinguishing of the whole mass of suffering. So again, the whole point there is to extinguish rebirth so you don't have any more old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, or any more birth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. That's how the Buddha says you come to the extinction of this whole mass of suffering. And again, the reason why you get the extinction of rebirth is by totally extinguishing craving, and then actually the fuel for rebirth is cut off. Hence the annihilation, cessation and overcoming of corporality, of more bodies, feelings, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness. This is the extinction of suffering, the end of disease, the overcoming of old age and death. Which is a very great sort of a quote there. The annihilation, cessation and overcoming. So it uses many words to make sure that people don't sort of misunderstand what it means. Of the five khandhas, including consciousness. The annihilation of consciousness, cessation and overcoming of consciousness. The annihilation, cessation of will. The annihilation, cessation and overcoming of happiness and suffering. That is the extinction of suffering. The end of disease, the overcoming of old age and death. So to overcome suffering, you can't just have happiness, like the idea of like a heaven afterwards. Questions on that?
I think Buddha's time, they also had like this kind of religion that, you know, more happiness you have in this life, you know, like really use, you know, like the senses, and you know, like that's the purpose of life.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons. It was also to power, wealth, fame, just like, you know, not just the sensory pleasures in the sense of like sex and good food, just like there's many different pleasures which people find in life, and it's also like power, influence, fame, it's also part of the sensory world, just like in the time of the Buddha. The time now is pretty much similar. If you want to get some great stories, just look at the Vinaya, Vinaya, and just don't look at the rules, but look at how the rules came about and all the sort of crazy stuff these monks did. These weren't the great monks, these were the really scallywag monks and nuns and all the stuff which they got up to. And it shows you that's... I love to ask people to look at those stories. They're easy to read and they're really good fun. And it really shows you that people haven't changed over 25 centuries. Exactly the same. They get up to all sorts of mischief. For a good example, they had this group of six monks, and there was this house which was offering them like a food. They used to invite the monks every week to this house, and the food was delicious at this house. So the monks would look actually forward to going to this house. And one day it became the turn of the group of six monks, and they had to go to this house. And even though this group of six monks were well known in the whole town of being scallywags, and they're really up to mischief and all sorts of unbecoming stuff. So when the donor heard that a group of six monks were coming, he told the cook, "Now forget about making anything delicious. Just serve these scallywag monks sour gruel with broken rice, which is now just like stuff for servants. And don't serve it to them in the house. Serve it to them in the servants' quarters." And so when the group of six monks heard they were going to have the meal at this great supporter's house, They said that night they did not sleep as much as expected. They have things like that. There's great little sayings there, which is, if you're going to have a really good meal tomorrow, I think, oh, great. You have all these expectations. And when they got to the house, they said, there must be some mistake. We come into the house for the dana. They said, no, we've been told about you. Go in the servants' quarters, you have sour gruel and rice, broken rice. And they were really upset. As a result of that, they started accusing the monk who was, you know, he was just doing his job, just saying who was going to go, Dabba the Malian. And they accused him of all sorts of scallywag stuff. First of all, they accused him of having sex with a bhikkhuni. And they soon proved that he couldn't do that. So then what they did, they saw these two goats having sex. And they named one of the goats, the male goat, they made him Dabba, the monk, and the other one they named Maitiya, the nun. And so they went up to the Buddha and said, look, actually this time we actually saw it with our own eyes, honest. We saw Dabba the monk having sex with Maitiya, the nun. And it's true, honest. And that's the sort of stuff these guys got up to, okay? So just the sort of same as people these days. Yeah, gross and coarse, but so people haven't changed at all. Yeah.
Why the function of the fourth noble truth is the way to give up craving, but didn't the Buddha already explain, you know, just give up craving?
Well, it's just again re-presenting it again, especially in the terms of, you know, you've got to sort of, the only way to do that is to, monks or people who see things as impermanent, dukkha, without a self, anatta, as diseases and cancers, they're the ones who overcome craving. In other words, that's called right view. And you know, you have the right intention there, which I keep on harping on, of letting go, renouncing, being kind, being gentle. And as a result of that, hopefully you have right speech, right action, right livelihood. Because that's all craving when you sort of speak wrongly or act wrongly. But as I mentioned, as a result of that, you can actually see that mindfulness starts to increase. So the effort to sort of say no, to stop, to renounce. And you can see mindfulness coming up, and you see the jhanas happening. So the Eightfold Path is an extension of that. Exactly. So they're complementary.
Okay.
And if you really did understand the third noble truth, that would be enough. Okay. But the fourth noble truth is just looking at it from a different angle, which is also helpful. Yeah.
Like the pleasure of the Dharma or the pleasure of the present moment.
Yeah.
The fact that you have to be very careful of not destroying that through negativity because of getting ideas that everything's suffering without really knowing it.
Exactly, yeah. You get negativity. That's why, again, sort of I tell people, if you think you're going to get attached to that, that's what you're supposed to do. Get attached to it. I gave some years ago the simile of a ladder. If you're climbing up a ladder, you have to attach, grab onto, grasp the rung above you, and let go of the rungs below you. So, you know, attach to that pleasure first of all, and let go of the pleasures of the lower things. And there comes a time when you're standing on that rung, then you let it go. So it's, you know, attaching to something higher to let go of something lower is a very beautiful simile. And now we've got some commentary here, and this is from Jnanatiloka. The undulatory motion which we call a wave and which in the... Did I do this last time? No. And which in the ignorant spectator creates the illusion of one and the same mass of water moving over the surface of the lake is produced and fed by the wind and maintained by the stored up energies. Now after the wind has ceased, and if no fresh wind again whips up the water of the lake, the stored up energies will gradually be consumed, and thus the whole undulatory motion will come to an end. Similarly, if fire does not get new fuel, it will, after consuming all the old fuel, become extinct. Just in the same way, this five-kanda process, which in the ignorant world creates the illusion of an ego entity, a self, it is produced and fed by the life-affirming craving, and maintained for the same time by means of the stored up life energies. Now after the fuel, now he's using Upadana's fuel, i.e. the craving and clinging to life has ceased, and if no new craving impels, again as five kind of process, life will continue as long as there are still life energies stored up, in other words, until you die. But at the destruction of death, the five kind of process will reach final extinction. Thus, nirvana, or extinction, Sanskrit nirvana, from nirvana, to cease by and become extinct, may be considered under two aspects. Namely, I'll stop for a moment there, because nirvana, it was, as I mentioned, used in common words. You see it in Pali, stories about when the oil lamp goes out, when the flame is extinguished. The word they used then was the flame nibbanas. And that's great when you learn Pali and you read all this stuff for yourself. You read like a story, maybe a jataka or something, and you come across this word. You say, that's actually used in Dharma as well. And they used these words because they were common usage. And so nibbana actually meant a flame which has ceased, it's gone out. And the Buddha used that simile in the Agni-Vajra-Gota Sutta. When the flame goes out, where does it go? Vajra-Gota, does it go to the north, south, east, west, or where does it go? It doesn't go anywhere, it's just ceased, that's all. In the same way, when the five khandhas cease, they don't go somewhere, they just cease. So it gives us the nirvana, it is an extinction, a cessation, a finishing.
So why do they use those Sanskrit things, you know, like cease, flowing? Is it different Sanskrit?
No, it's exactly the same word, but they're using many, many different words to sort of point to the same thing. Cease, extinguish, finish, gone, poof. So, just like in a dictionary. So you try and describe an event or something from many, many different similes so that it becomes very clear when you surround it many, many different ways. Then you get an accurate description of what it really truly is.
Why do they refer to the Sanskrit word?
The Sanskrit word, nirvana, extinguishing, that is the etymology. And as many people know, the etymology is very difficult, and it's not necessarily the way things are used. If you look at the etymology of the English phrase, this afternoon it was raining cats and dogs. Look at the etymology of that, what the words actually mean. I mean, it's rubbish. You don't have cats and dogs falling from the sky. But it is actually a idiom. And much words we use are idioms. You can think of another sort of stupid idiom. Another one is good. Now, did you have a good day today? I had a terribly good day today. And that's an English word. Terribly. If you look at it etymologically, it means full of terror, full of fear. But now that's actually what it means according to the word. But we never use it in that way anymore. We use it as terribly, means very, extreme. So it's an amplifier word. But etymologically, it actually means full of fear and full of terror. So that's why that many people say these words, if you look at the etymology, you take a word and you analyze its parts. Now, the full meaning is not the sum of its parts. Sometimes it can be totally different. So that's why a lot of people just don't worry about etymology, but sometimes people try it anyway. But anyway, the two types of nibbana, this is from the text, so this is accurate, is called kilesa parinibbana. This is, you see it's got pari in front there, that means complete. Extinction of impurities, kilesa parinibbana, reach to the attainment of arahatship or holiness, which generally takes place during lifetime. In the suttas it's called sa upadisesa nibbana. Sat means with, upadisesa means with things remaining. So that's nibbana with the groups of existing remaining, or something remaining. So that's the arahat, there's still bodies there, they still feel pleasure or pain, they've still got will, they've still got consciousness. But the cause of rebirth has been totally extinguished. And the extinction of the five khanda process. This is the khandas have gone, which is the real parinibbana, which takes place at the death of the arahat, called in the sutras an upadisesa nibbana, nibbana without anything remaining. So that's the two types of nibbana, the arahat and with nothing remaining. And again, I mentioned nothing remaining because people always try and make this something remaining. So here we go again, some more definitions of nirvana. This truly is peace. This is the highest, namely the end of all karma formations. That's actually all sankharas. It is actually that word, sabba sankhara samatha. It's the samatha-ing of all sankharas. The forsaking of every substratum of rebirth, or actually the causes of rebirth. The fading away of craving, detachment extinguished nirvana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed with mind ensnared, man and women aim at their own ruin and the ruin of others. It's amazing that when people get hurt, they want to sort of hurt other people. When someone gets ruined, they want to sort of destroy others. At the ruin of both, and they experience mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, this is the greed, hate, and delusion bit. If they are given up, then human beings aim neither at your own ruin nor the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and they experience no mental pain and grief. It's amazing just how people just want to ruin everything for everybody. So you want to destroy the monastery because you didn't have fun. I'm not going to allow anyone else to have fun. It's amazing just how mean people can be. It's just almost unintelligible. This is nirvana, immediately visible in this life, that's Sanditika, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. Another definition of nirvana, the extinction of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's also called nirvana. Which type of nirvana is that called? Is something remaining or without remaining? The extinction of greed, hate, and delusion. Sorry? With something remaining. Yeah, that's sat, upadi stays in nirvana. The arahat, or the holy one. And for a disciple thus freed, in whose heart dwells peace, there is nothing to be added to what has been done, and naught remains for them to do. Just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so neither forms nor sounds nor odours nor tastes nor contacts of any kind, neither desire nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is their mind gained in deliverance, just like a rock unshaken by the wind. So that's one who's dwelling in peace, the arahat. Now what's really important there is nothing to be added to what has been done. Now what do you think the Buddha is pointing to there? He's pointing to the idea, and you find this, I've seen this in sort of magazines, especially, I mean it's this Chan magazine for the Mahayana that said, yeah, it's very good to be enlightened, to be an arahat, and if you really work hard after you become an arahat, you can actually go to the next stage of being a bodhisattva. Which is, you know, a little bit sus, especially when you read things like this. The idea of an arahat is actually the end. And this is why the Buddha actually mentions there's nothing to be added to what has been done, nor what remains for them to do.
Don't they, like, if you are arahat, don't they usually, like, try to...
Oh, they teach, yeah, they can't.
Teach, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but there's nothing more to add to their attainment.
Right, yeah, it's for other people.
That's right, yeah. So it's not as if that's like, okay, that's like university. You got your BA, then you can go to an MA, then you can go a PhD, and then you can get something else. So the attainment is complete.
We have time. Can I ask
a bodhisattva
question?
Yeah, okay, I mentioned it now, so go on.
Then you know how the extreme part of the bodhisattva practice?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Like often when you hear people have families, and one for dying suggested to them, well, guard your family.
Yeah.
I'm wondering with the way the bodhisattva left his wife and child, whether that was part of the extreme part.
A lot of people say that, because here in the West, people read that and they say, look, that is just really off. That the Buddha actually just abandoned his wife and kid. Now, what type of example is that to us? And, of course, the answer I usually give, well, look, now, this was a bit special. His family were incredibly well off, and it wasn't as if his wife and kid would be destitute. I mean, they lived in a palace, for goodness sake. So at least he knew that his wife and kid were going to be extremely well looked after. So that's one important point. So, you know, if you are that wealthy and you've got a wife and kid, then maybe. But even so, the other thing that, you know, you've got to be a bit careful of what you're running away from. So if anyone did that here and they said they want to become a monk and they had like a wife and kid, I'd be very, very careful. But, you know, I usually wouldn't sort of allow them to ordain. Got to do your duty first of all. If you run away from your family like that, you're not going to stay as long as a monk. As soon as it gets tough, you're going to run away from here. Yes. Okay. And the extinction of suffering. This is extinction of suffering. Page 25. You're going to get some really interesting stuff in a moment. And they who have considered all the contrasts on this earth, in other words, all the black and white, the happiness, suffering, everything, and is no more disturbed by anything, whatever, in the world, the peaceful one, freed from rage, from sorrow and from longing, they are passed beyond birth and decay. This is actually all the contrasts, all the duality of the world, of just likes and dislikes, fame and blame, praise and blame, and fame and notoriety. And all this, whenever you have one, you have to have the other. So you can't have just be famous without some notoriety. You can't have praise without blame. You can't have happiness without suffering. That's why, you know, these are all contrasts. You can't have health without sickness. You can't have fish without chips. Well, maybe I'll go a bit too far there. Yes. Fame and notoriety is fame when people are really, you're such a great guy, Greg. You're so well known throughout the whole Buddhist world. Now, Greg has come to visit us for the mains. That's fame and notoriety. Oh, that Greg guy! You should have seen what he did at sort of Bante G's monastery last range retreat. You know, you're notorious for your misbehaviour. So that's notoriety. I mean, it's like the opposite. You're famous for your bad behaviour. But that's not an example. I'm not sort of being specific. I'm sure that you're well regarded wherever you go. I have to say that because he's much bigger than me. But it's true too. So now here we go. The immutable. Now this is controversial. And these passages are often quoted. And first of all, I'll go to the bottom. That is from the Udana. So this is not central part of the Buddha's teachings. This is on the edge of the Kuddhika Nikaya. So this is not Majjhima, not Sanghita, not Anguttara. So you don't find this quote there. So this is on the sort of the edge part of the suttas. It's fine, except it's really badly translated. But I'll read it first of all. And it actually shows you why these things are translated in this way. Truly, there is a realm where there is neither the solid nor the fluid, neither heat nor motion, neither this world nor any other world, neither sun nor moon. This I call neither arising nor passing away, neither standing still nor being born nor dying. There is neither foothold nor development nor any basis. This is the end of suffering. Which is great, except number one, truly, that's not in the Pali. I've got the Pali up here. There is a realm. Now the word here, which is translated as realm, is ayatana. Now ayatana is not a realm in the sense of a place. And a good example of that, you have like the ayatana of the eye, sense base, the ear base, the nose base, the sort of the taste base, the body base, the mind base. Those are called the six ayatanas. So it's not meant to ever be considered to be like a place. This is just the idiom in Pali to say, like the sense of sight, it has its like area, it's actually its place. And so even though we say area and place, it doesn't mean a physical place, it doesn't mean like a place where you get reborn into. And of course, the reason why people translate like this is because there's always that inclination of the mind to create a place, a realm where people go to after they become arahats.
So what word would you use?
There isn't a word, it's just there's an ayatana. The next paragraph is probably even more notorious. There is an unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. If there were not this unborn, this unoriginated, this uncreated and unformed, escape from the world of the born, the originated, the created, the formed would not be possible. But since there is an unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed, therefore is escape possible from the world of the born, the originated, the created, the formed. Now, have you ever heard someone describe a character which is quite well known, called God? Is unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. So why do we call this? There is God. If there were not this God, escape from the world of the born, originated, created, and formed would not be possible. That's actually what it's saying. And you notice that's really, so that's not sort of Buddhism. The mistake, which if you ever read my book, The Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, I mentioned this point. This is actually, again, where you need to be very careful when you're translating. The actual Pali words is ajatang, abhutang, akatang, asankatang, ajatang. Jatang means born. You put the at in front of it. Abhutang, a being. Akatang is a made. Sankatang, like sankara, is formed. And when you put at in front, you can look in any Pali dictionary. The at prefix in Pali is called a privative prefix. It means it's not the opposite. It means the absence of what follows afterwards. So if you're being absolutely precise in your language, you'd say there is an absence of the born. There is an absence of the originated. There's the absence of created. There's the absence of anything formed or made. Now that doesn't mean, it's totally different than saying there is an unborn or an unoriginated. Exactly. And the simile which I used over in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond was actually a story, again, from the time of the Buddha. There's one of the great monks there called Anuruddha. And his story, when he was a young boy, he had a very wealthy, came from a wealthy family, and as a boy he was playing like these marbles with his friends, and he was gambling his lunch. And his mum had made him these little cakes for his lunch. And he wasn't very good at playing marbles because he lost. And so he had a servant there, because he was a very wealthy family. He told his servant, go and get some more cakes so I can carry on gambling. So his servant came back with some more cakes, and he lost those too, and sent back again. And so his mother gave him the more cakes, and his servant brought them back, and he lost those as well. So for the fourth time, he sent the servant back with the basket to get some cakes from his mum. And his mum says, we've run out. There is no cakes. And in Pali, the word for there is nothing is natti. And so he's actually saying, natti cakes. There's no cakes. And so the servant came back with the basket, you know, with that instruction from the mother, natty cakes, there's no cakes. But because this monk, he wasn't a monk, he was just a kid, because of his past good karma, he'd made such good karma in the past, I think feeding some arahats or something, that in this life, he must never hear the word, there's nothing. Well, he hasn't got it. Whatever he wants, he has to get. That was his karma. So when the devas saw this, they realized they had to intervene to maintain the law of karma. So they put some heavenly cakes in the basket secretly. So when he arrived at the place where they're playing marbles, the servant said, natty cakes. And so the Anuruddha took the basket and opened it and had these heavenly cakes. I mean, this was really delicious. And he tasted one of these heavenly cakes and said, these natty cakes are delicious. My mother doesn't love me. She's the first time, you know, since I got these natty cakes. Why hasn't she given me these natty cakes before? And so natty cakes, which really should mean no cakes, actually became a cake. Just like the unborn becomes a thing. And even the other example I gave was from Alice in Wonderland. And if you remember that story, that Alice got to the place where the Red Queen was. And when she arrived at the place where the Red Queen was asking her, she was saying, "I'm waiting for my messenger. Did you pass the messenger on the way?" And Nadis said, "I passed no one sort of on the way." No, actually, she said, "I saw no one on the way here." And the Queen said, "You saw no one? You must have very good eyes. It's hard for me to see someone, let alone see no one. You must have very good eyes." "And did you pass anyone? Or did anyone pass you on the road?" And he said, "Actually, no one passed me on the road." That's true, that's logical, because no one got here before you. And then soon the messenger arrived. And the messenger sort of came. And the Queen said, "You're very late. You know, you walk very slow." And the messenger said, "What do you mean walking slow? No one walks faster than me." And the Queen said, "Yeah, that's right, because no one got here first." And so this is by Lewis Carroll's making this joke about when you say no one, it's very easy to make no one a thing, a person. To make no cakes a certain type of cakes. To make the absence of birth a thing. Rather than really a no thing. And this is actually the big mistake of this paragraph. It doesn't mean there is an unborn. It means it's almost like there's an end of birth. There is a no birth. There is no origination. There is a no created. There is a no form. There's an absence of these things. If there were not the absence of these things, there'd be no escape from these things. And that's all the Buddha's really saying there. I've spent a lot of time on there because that particular phrase, that particular passage is quoted so often to suggest, you know, like a god or a sort of a heaven for a Buddhist once you become enlightened. But it's really sort of, number one, you see it doesn't fit in with everything else, and number two, it's a very sort of bad translation. Yeah, but also, why do people perpetuate that bad translation? Because at last they found a place, you know, somewhere in the suttas where it says, yeah, there's something left after Nibbana. And that's why it's such a sort of small little place in the sort of, not sort of the main part of the Buddha's teachings. And they quote that, and it's created a lot of mischief when they haven't translated it carefully. Yeah. Ayatana, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Is it in the
Atamas? Oh, no, I don't know, I haven't checked for that one. But they say, Ati Bhikkhave Tad Ayatana.
Because Ayatana, I mean, just in the other context you put it, it's conditioned, so you can't, and then you say, and then you could arrive at the path of life, but it's kind of like, just having the word is a
sign of the
whole purpose.
Yeah, it is. That's right, yeah. But it's just a word in Pali which hasn't got a similar word in English. I've got actually the definition from the Pali Text Society in my little book. It's a resting place, abode, source, region, sphere, field, area, stretch, extent, reach, compass, region, sphere, locus, spot, position, occasion. And it also actually mentions here that the full quote is, "There is, monks, that ayatana, where there is not earth, air, fire or water." This is where he's got solid, fluid, heat or motion. "There is not the ayatana of unbounded space, not the ayatana of unbounded consciousness, not the ayatana of nothingness, not the ayatana of neither perception nor non-perception," because those are also ayatanas. The immaterial realms, that's what they call them, ayatanas, because they're not a place. And then they have the afterwards. They didn't actually put that in this translation here. "Not that this world or an afterlife, no moon, no sun." They have that in there. No coming, no going, no standing, no falling away, no arising, no establishment.
There's
Yeah, the item there is like they've got some idea here, a locus, spot, position, occasion, compass. It's just actually, you might call like a field in like field theory in mathematics.
But it's not.
A group, yeah.
But
not an ayatana. No, but you know, you can actually call it a name, so it is in that sense an ayatana. You can call it a spot, a position, you can give it a name.
But isn't it just like cessation?
Yeah, cessation, yeah. This is just the way they use language.
Okay.
Cessation is a word.
Could you probably just add that so you can ignore it?
No, I think that's probably there originally. The state is another good word for it. I have to know. It doesn't mean it's a place. Yeah. It can be. There's all these words for it, but again, there's nothing which is, as you know, you know some Polish. There are some words in Polish which just haven't got meanings in English.
Cessation,
yeah. Now, there's also something which you've heard me say before, but I got this from Venerable Jnana Tiloka. Fortunate enough to go to Sri Lanka many years ago, and had a great time there because I managed to see all these great monks who were there at the time. And Jnana Tiloka was getting very, very old. He's been looked after by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And for those who think that Bhikkhu Bodhi is just a great scholar, he was like looking after Jnana Tiloka like a son looks after his father. It was really impressive. Doing everything for him. And you could see actually the love and devotion there. And that gave you another example of just how a monk should behave to their teacher. So it was wonderful to see, and just they were discussing a few things, and they were discussing, this is one of the things which Jnana Tiloka said, and I will always remember this, he said, you should never interpret the whole of the Buddha's teachings in the suttas on the basis of one or two obscure passages. And this is what this is like, an obscure passage, you know, people argue over its meaning, it's in an obscure part of the suttas. So you shouldn't interpret this passage, so you shouldn't use this passage to interpret the rest of the teachings of the Buddha. You should interpret this passage in light of the whole mass of teachings on things like cessation. That's a very good point because, you know, with the mass of teachings in the suttas, you can always find something. And if you translate it in a weird way, you can actually have a different meaning. And then you try and interpret the whole of all the other things which the Buddha said in light of that one dubious meaning. And the point is that there's so much teachings of the Buddha, there's such a mass of them, that, you know, what is actually very clear is, from reading the mass of it, it becomes the teachings of the Buddha. And from those main teachings of the Buddha, you interpret something like this. So you don't get lost. And when you actually look at the translation, this was actually look at the original part, it was a sort of a reasonable thing that the Buddha said. But it doesn't mean there is that nirvana is an unborn a place. It means everything stops, ceases. Yeah, that's right, yeah. That's another thing.
A different take on it than if it was a Sutta. Because he's given some kind of
inspiration, yeah. This is another thing which I got from reading A.K. Warder. If any of you wishes to learn Pali, A.K. Warder's Introduction to Pali is absolutely brilliant. It's not just because of its technical detail, because he teaches you how to translate. One thing he'd always say, you never translate word for word. It's phrase from phrase. Because the unit of language is like an idea, a phrase. So word by word, you have some stupid translations. So you say, what's the person trying to say? And then you understand, you translate, it rained cats and dogs, you say it rained heavily. You don't translate cat and dog into Bahasa Malaysia or into Polish, it doesn't make any sense. So the unit for translations is not the word, it's actually the phrase, that part of the sentence. And the other thing which he actually said in there, which was, what was the other thing? It was poetry, that's right, yeah. Was that in the poetic parts of the suttas, and he was actually the expert on poetry, all Indian poetry, and that was his strength, his main sort of area of expertise. He said, poetry is never meant to be definitive. It's supposed to actually just to give you a mood, to be inspirational. So when Wordsworth said, "I wandered lonely as a cloud," it didn't mean he was sort of levitating up in the sky somewhere. But you can understand, like a cloud, it just moves sort of slowly through the sky. And that's what he was meaning. He was getting sort of a feeling idea. And that's the great skill of poets, that through words which are never meant to be taken as real, it was actually giving them a feeling, an emotion coming up. And that's the other thing he said, that for the poetic parts of the Pali Canon, they're not really meant to give you the instructions and the theory in detail. It was more sort of just inspirational. Okay. The fourth noble truth. We go a little bit into this. So first of all, and this is very good, the Buddha starts off, the two extremes and the middle and the middle path. To give oneself up to indulgence in sensual pleasure, the base, common, vulgar, unholy, unprofitable. This is actually, you know what it means, the base? The word there is hina. Hina, yeah. So that's actually the hina. So really, hina jnana, according to the word of the Buddha, is actually people who indulge in sensual pleasure. The original meaning was nothing to do with sort of people trying to get enlightened. So that's the hina, gamo, pochujaniko, anario, anatta sanyato. Anatta sanyato means it's got no real benefit there, no profit.
Is the hina, is the deliberation?
Absolutely, yes. Indeed, yeah. That's why that I did actually write to the Oxford English Dictionary, because when I looked in there and had Hinayana, and had sort of, that was Theravada. So under Theravada they had Hinayana. And I objected and saying that's like calling a black African a nigger.
Exactly.
And it was like, and it was, because if, and I actually photocopied the, especially Monier Williams Sanskrit English Dictionary, and if you look what it says about Hina there, it's really gross. And I sent it to them and I told him that, you know, I knew Richard Gombrich, he was at Oxford too at that time, he's a professor, just ask him, this is like an offensive word. And they took it on board, they thanked me, and so they didn't put it in there anymore. Yeah, so it's very good. I realised that Oxford people aren't all that bad after all, even though that's what I was taught when I was at Cambridge. So anyway. Yeah, you can do, yeah. And some people have objected to the Dalai Lama as well. So you can't call it Hinayana, because that's a very, very offensive word. For people who know their Pali and their Sanskrit, that really is offensive. And it's not totally un-Buddhist.
You can say the teachings of the elders.
Yeah, you can do that. Anyway, that's another thing. So to give oneself up to self-profitable, or to give oneself up to self-mortification, the painful, unholy, unprofitable, both of these two extremes. So, you know, as Buddhists, you know, we don't fast too much. We eat to keep ourselves healthy. We sleep enough. We don't sleep too much, we don't sleep too little, we keep our bodies very healthy. And, you know, you might be able to endure at first, you know, fasting or not sleeping, but you have the consequences afterwards. And I've got to be very careful, because if any of you get sick, you know, I'm the one who has to arrange for you to go to the hospital. And in the end, you know, if somebody gets really sick over here, that I'm the one who has to face the newspapers and say, why do you allow this person to fast for so long? Why did you allow them not to sleep? Why do you allow them to, you know, stand on one leg for 10 days? So please, out of compassion for me, look after your health.
Don't die here.
Don't die here. No, don't even get sick here. So don't have self-mortification. If it's painful, it's unholy, unprofitable. So you have the middle way. So both these two extremes, the perfect one has avoided, has found out the middle path, which makes one both to see and to know, which leads to peace, to disenchantment, to enlightenment, to nibbana, and that middle path. And you all know that when the Buddha started that middle path, his five friends thought he'd lost it. He thought that he was just abandoning the path. He thought you were indulging. So remember that sometimes, even today, people, you know, it's, some people just lean towards indulgence. But actually the biggest danger is leaning towards asceticism. And for most of us, we think, oh, no, we're sort of, we're indulging. You're indulging. But check what people are doing outside in the world. And then look what you're doing, and this is not indulging at all. Even the great food we have every day. You know, that actually is not indulging when you look at what other people do outside. Once we had these visitors, they came to visit New Norcia Monastery, the Benedictine Monastery, and then they came here. And afterwards they say, if we were to become monks, we'd go to the New Norcia Monastery. This is too tough. So actually sometimes when you live here, you sort of, I think it's like the Western guilt. You feel, gee, we're having a good meal. We've got a nice place to sleep at night. You know, we should be sleeping out there under the rain. We should be eating just, brown rice and just a bit of salt maybe, and that's it. We should be having sort of, tea and coffee in the afternoon. But be careful, because I'm saying this as a teacher. Sort of, usually the Westerners especially, they err on asceticism. And it's very dangerous, and I've seen too many people being too ascetic and causing pain to their body.
Yeah. Like
great, yeah.
And all that, so that's the middle way.
Middle way is a comfortable body, so it's not sort of screaming at you to feed me, to lay me down, to I've got to go to sleep. It's not screaming at you anymore, it's like it's malleable. You can work with it. That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah. Let's find that out soon, because the middle way is the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the middle way. They say here, the two extremes, peace to peace and suffering to enlightenment. The middle way is, it is the Noble Eightfold Path, the way that leads to the extinction of suffering, namely, samadhi, right understanding, or right view. I pause there for a bit, because you're supposed to have a view. The idea is that I'm supposed to have no views. That's Buddhism. I think that's a view. Everyone's got a view. So you've got a view. You can't have no views. If you have no views, you're absolutely crazy. You're mad. Everyone's got a view. So the point is, have a good view, a right view. Of course it does. Yeah. It has to have a view. But sometimes, some people say, no, the idea is have no views. No views at all. And that's absolutely crazy. When you sort of use that logically, you're just, it's so easy to sort of overcome. But anyway, you have a view.
When they say grasp all views at the end,
that's right, yeah.
Doesn't that mean wrong view?
Indeed, yes, very good. Because a lot of times in Pali, when the word used ditti, it means the wrong view. And samaditti is the right view. So the 63 dittis, the 63 wrong views in the Brahmajala Sutta. So they're called ditti, micha ditti. And you got right thought. Now, you may talk about this a lot, sankalpa, it also means, actually literally means planning, intentions, it's where you want to go to. So it's, you can understand why they call it thought, because much of your thought is planning or working things out. So that's why, you've heard me say before, and it'll come up soon, right thought, samasankalpa, is thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of kindness, thoughts of gentleness, of non-harm. So you can see it's actually just not particular thoughts, but just where your thought is leading to. And you've got the morality, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, which we'll come up to later on. And then we've got right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. This is the middle path, which the perfect one has found out, which makes one both see and know, which leads to peace, to discernment, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Now I've got a little bit of commentary here. The figurative expression, path or way, has been sometimes misunderstood as implying that the single factors of the path have to be taken up for practice one after the other in the order given. In that case, right understanding of the full penetration of the truth would have to be realized first before one could think of developing right thought or practicing right speech, etc. But in reality, the three factors forming the sexual morality have to be perfected first. After that, one has to give attention to the systematic training by mind, by practicing three factors, forming the sexual concentration. Only after that preparation, man's character and mind will be capable of reaching perfection of the first two factors, forming the sexual of wisdom, panya. Is that right? There is actually a sutta in the Anguttara which says you have to perfect right understanding first, samadhiti, before you can do right thought, and right thought before right speech, before right action, before right pride, before right effort, before right mindfulness, before right samadhi. That's in there. So what is the answer to that conundrum? Should the Eightfold Path be developed just one after the other, from 1 to 8, or is it developed in any old order? Who knows the answer to this question this evening?
I'm not quite sure, but I remember from last year that he said right view is kind of there when someone is a stream enter. So that's kind of the training starts from there on, but somehow you have to get to that point, so you need the other factors to get there.
Smart guy. So before the attainment of stream winning, you could be all over the place. Bit of right stillness, a bit of right effort, a bit of right speech. So up to stream winning, all over the place. But at streaming, the first of these factors, which is perfected, say perfected, I mean down to its fullness, is samadhiti. And when you have samadhiti, then you're a stream winner. And as you are a stream winner, then you start practicing these other ones. You can really know what samasankappa really is. You know how to renounce. When you really have seen non-self, you know what renouncing is. And of course, speech, action, once you renounce, once you're kind, once you're gentle, speech, action and livelihood have to be sort of perfect. Now once you understand samadhiti, non-self, you understand what right effort is. It means being still, it's just not coming from you anymore. And only when you can be let go of all this craving and this doing stuff, can your mindfulness start to get strong and be powerful enough to actually understand this mind and get into these jhanas full on. So the stillness there. So in that sense, yes, it is, after stream winning, it is a one after the other, as it says in the Anguttara Nikaya. So once you complete that path, you've been a stream winner, and you've perfected right understanding, thought, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and stillness, then what can you call yourself? Aryan, as soon as you've done the understanding, you're an Aryan. At that particular part of perfection, what stage are you at now? Oh, you know all my tricks. Yeah, an anagami, yes. That's one has perfected samadhi. And then afterwards, it is the last bit of wisdom comes after that, where you become an arahant. That's why in the Anguttara there is a tenfold path. The eight, and then the last two, is Sama Vimutti and Sama Vimutti Yana. So right liberation. And I like the last one, the knowledge of liberation. They have to come. So you're not only an arahant, you know you're an arahant. That's a noble eightfold path. Okay, so there is a sense. He's not wrong here in Yantaloka, but he misses out the Anguttara one as well. An initial minimum of right understanding, however, is required at the very start, because some grasp of the facts of suffering is necessary to provide convincing reasons and an incentive for diligent practice of the path. A measure of right understanding is also required for helping other path factors to fulfill intelligently and efficiently their individual functions in the common task of liberation. For that reason, and to emphasize the importance of that fact, right understanding has been given the first place in the Noble Eightfold Path. The initial understanding of the Dharma, however, has to be gradually developed with the help of the other path factors until it reaches finally the highest clarity of insight, which is the immediate condition of entering the four stages of holiness. That's Abhidharma. Right understanding is therefore a beginning as well as a culmination of the Noble Eightfold Path. Not really. Culmination of the Samadhi. Beginning, as in the list. Anyway, then this is one of my favourite quotes on page 28. Listen to this one, everybody, pay attention. This is one of my favourite quotes. Free from pain and torture is this path. Free from groaning and suffering, it is the perfect path. So if you're groaning in your meditation, come on, all this is suffering. You've missed the path. And if you think, look at that monk over there, they're too happy, they can't be practicing. you misunderstood. If they are not groaning, they're happy, having a good time, not in a sensory way, but in another way, then they found the path. It is a perfect path, free from pain and torture, free from groaning and suffering. So if you're groaning in your meditation, you've missed the path. Yeah, go on.
Because speaking of Germany, because I stayed in the nunnery in Germany,
yeah.
And then I was happy, and then she said, "Why are you smiling? No smiling."
Yeah. That's right. Because again, people have that sort of inclination, aestheticism. The real serious ones, the ones who are suffering. Okay, truly like this path, there is no other path to the purity of insight. That's from Dhammapada, yeah. That is the middle path. It is Aesowa Magga. This, and actually they don't say the Awa here. It said this the only path. There is no other path to the purity of insight. They don't have only there. And Awa actually means only. Aesowa Magga. So truly, this is the only path. There is no other to the purity of insight. If you follow this path, you'll put an end to suffering. But each one has to struggle for in themselves. And struggle is the wrong word, but he has to sort of work for themselves. The perfect ones have only pointed the way. That's all the case. So you can't sort of have divine intervention and go up to the Buddha and say, "Can you give me some holy water, some strings, some chantings to make my meditation better?" What I say is that here are the empty places, your hearts meditate. So the perfect ones only point out the way. Give ear then, it's an old English word, listen you fools. For the deathless is found. I set forth the truth. As I reveal it to you, so act. And that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which sons and daughters of good families, and even bad families, rightly go forth from home to the homeless state. This you will in no long time. It's a great saying, no long time. In this very life, make known to yourself, realize and make your own. And sometimes I linger on that saying because it's saying that yes, you can do it. So listen to the teachings, practice them, and then realize the reason why you sort of got into this Buddhism in the first place, especially the reason why you sort of left your home, became novices, anagarikas, monks, eventually, you'll realize that, become enlightened. Why not? You will in no long time in this very life make known to yourself. So you're all sons and daughters of good families. So you can do it. So there we go. Yep.
We obviously don't have the right view, otherwise we'd be enlightened.
Yep.
But at the same time, we come here to get the right view.
Mm-hmm.
That's the purpose of reading the suttas or having a teacher.
Yeah.
So, actually, we should accept, if we accept and have faith in the right view, that's the practice.
Sort of. It shows you what to do, because the Buddha said, "I can only point in a way." The Buddha can't give you right view. He points a way for you to find right view.
So the question, the real question I have, is very hard to even explain the question. We can't have right view at the same time we have to have right view. Otherwise we can't practice. You know, it's a very, it's tricky.
Now, right view is what you find. That's the treasure. So what the Buddha is actually pointing out this time is actually how to find that treasure. That's the right view before stream winning. So that's the path, the way, what to do, how to find the treasure. And then you make the right view your own.
So it has to be experienced.
It has to be experienced.
So no, we take the words of the teacher and or the suttas, and we use those, we try as best we can intellectually,
yeah,
to use those as practice tools.
Yeah. So then that, and up to that time, there's somebody else's, which you're taking on faith.
Mm-hmm. It's faith.
And yeah, until you see it for yourself and then it becomes yours. As it says, you make it your own. So it's not, no longer is it sort of Ajahn Chah's teachings or the Buddha's teachings or their sayings, it's your sayings.
So now I'm getting, I think I have, that the problem is we don't really have faith in the teachings until we become arrogant. After we don't have that unshakable faith.
Yeah, well actually afterwards it's not really faith anymore.
Yeah, because you've seen having
faith.
So we still, we have to increase, actually the faith is so important then.
Faith is dangerous though, because we can have faith in. Because some people are just very, very convincing.
But until you enter, you're just going with the faith, right?
You go with the faith, yeah. Some faith, but also some experience as well. So you're not totally experienced, but you're always testing out faith, always questioning. So never, ever, please, don't just believe it because I say it. Because if I say it, well, I say it might be true, by the time it sort of travels into your ear, it gets into your head, it becomes suddenly totally different than what I actually said. That's the trouble with faith.
So we should always check. We should actually be checking back with you about our right view all the time.
Just checking with your experience.
Yeah. But we have to check with you too, because we may have an experience with right view.
Check with this.
Check with it.
With the Buddha's teaching.
Yes.
That's the best. That's a good
path,
that's a good sort of indicator you're on the right path. That's why I always stress that free from pain and torture is the path, free from groaning and suffering is the perfect path. So if you're going on, there's less and less suffering, more ease, more peace, more sense of inner freedom, you must be going on the right path.
So dukkha is what's unwholesome.
Indeed, yes. And it's dukkha is not something which is overcome all in one go. It's overcome little by little. It gets less and less and less. You do have these great moments, and a whole heap is let go of. But as you practice more and more, the dukkha gets less and less. That's a very good sort of way to understand the path. Yeah, you've got his hand up just quickly. Yeah. Go on.
I was thinking to me, going back to the beginning,
Yeah.
It seems to me that what is the middle way in terms of material comforts must change over time. Because, for example, now we have gas in the house.
Yes, yeah.
Whereas we didn't before.
That's very true.
And this is because basically people grow up with gas.
That's right, yeah.
But what they expect. And so, in some ways, over time, they're gradually getting more and more. Self-sensory.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of like sensory comfort because, like, the heat, sort of the softer, soft beds, it's just actually taking away discomfort. Whereas the TVs and sort of the spa baths, you know, they're extra to what's really needed for comfort, they're more stimulation.
Yeah, okay. So that's
so, I would also say sensory stimulation rather than sensory. Suppression. Yeah. There's one point I never made here, which I should have, and you bring it up now, and this is made very clear in the Anuvibhaga Sutta. You say that to avoid the extremes, one is like the pain of the six senses, and the other one is the happiness of the five senses. The Kama Sukha is the first, and that's always the five sense happiness, and then all pain from all six senses. And the Anuvibhaga Sutta makes that point, look, what's missing? If you avoid the pain of the six senses and the happiness of the five senses, the thing which is left out, quite conspicuous, is the happiness of the six senses. And so developing the happiness of the six senses is the middle point, middle way. It's a great way of putting it. So six sense pain, that's one extreme. Five sense happiness is the other extreme. And the middle way between those is the happiness of the mind.
But there would be a problem still. If you stay in the middle where you just said, then if we're comfortable, you avoid the pain, the suffering. And the suffering is the greatest teacher. It's the first teacher.
It can be.
I'm not saying we should go after suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we make it so that we're always comfortable, we're missing something. Because even in the posture, just sitting, you can't sit forever, you'll get uncomfortable.
Unless you get to jhanas. Not physically, because physically it's one of the weird things. If you get in any deep meditation, you come out sitting 3 or 4 hours and there's not a pain in your body.
So then after that there will be pain.
Oh yeah, no, after all the sort of the jhana of this disappears.
But what I'm saying is, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
I'm saying that the pain is not, we're not looking for pain, but to have the pain is a constant reminder that you are suffering.
Yeah, you can do that, yeah.
I don't think it's...
Yeah, but it's something you shouldn't go looking for. There's enough suffering anyway in life. You don't need to go looking for it by sort of being ascetic.
I'm sure that misses the point. Things like impermanence and
suffering. Yeah, impermanence shows you enough suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah, but going for the happiness of the mind, that's an important part. That's not sort of that's not an indulgence. In the sense of it's not part of the two extremes. So, go for the happiness of the mind. If you get blissed out from a meditation, or you get inspired by a great act of generosity or kindness, or you really sort of enjoy a nice sutta, then get inspired by it. Go for it. Because that's actually part of the middle way. If you just go for equanimity, no pleasure at all, so no smiling, which means you never get into any deep meditations. Pity sukha is part of the meditation practice. Yeah. So I think Greg had his hand up first of all. Okay. Very good. Okay, yeah. Yeah. I think it's okay saying that, but the delighting feeling has to be done gradually. So stop the delight in the 5 senses first of all, and then afterwards stop the delight in the 6 sense.
So the eightfold path is like a gradual way of not delighting.
First of all, in the 5 senses, which is how you get samadhi, how do you get stillness and jhanas, and then not delighting in that one, which is where you go from anagami to arahat.
And
not really, except maybe just samasankapa, just renouncing.
Renouncing the self.
Yes, it's easy renouncing will.
If there is no self, there is nothing to be enjoyed.
There is, just the joy of just seeing everything disappear. So joy is actually an important part of the path. That's why it's a path without groaning. Okay, I think that's enough for tonight, because next time we'll come to right understanding. Now this keeps on going on for a long time, which is very good, yeah. For the first of the Eightfold Path.